He's got a beautiful backswing.
Dad, oh, he got all of that one.
Oh my gosh.
That is amazing.
Layup with an iron into the hazard.
Well, that wasn't quite what I meant, you know.
Welcome in, everybody, to another edition of the 73rd Hole. Colby Powell and Taylor Williams with you as always. We got a great guest today, Jim Woodward, former Oklahoma State golfer, longtime PGA Tour member, and now he's out at Oak Tree National doing some teaching, is going to join us today. We're really looking forward to that. Make sure you find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Search the 73rd Hole. You will find us. Like us on all those different platforms and interact with us. Let us know what you want to hear, what you like, don't like, and we'll try to keep bringing you the best golf content that we can moving forward. And take 2 minutes, rate and subscribe this podcast wherever you are listening. Taylor Williams with me as always today. I want to remind everybody, head down to Taylor and I's hometown, our old stomping grounds, Bushwood Golf and Country Club down in Chickasha. Going to have a big Memorial Day tournament here in a couple weeks, kind of an impromptu thing now that everything is getting opened back up. Of course, always the Ouachita Valley out there over July 4th weekend, but now having an impromptu tournament over Memorial Day weekend as well, and getting the pool open, full bar going, so taking tee times down there now. The course has been packed lately. It's in a lot better shape, and obviously Max Stewart doing a great job getting it where it needs to be, so everybody is enjoying it. So I'll have to see if I can make my way down there over Memorial Day weekend. Might have to talk to the wife about that one.
You might have to pull some strings to get down there, but I'm sure you'll find a way. But Max does nothing but throw a great tournament. You know, it's not only going to be good setup course, and it's just going to be a great fun environment. Like I said, the pool is opening up, then there's going to be the bar. I mean, it's just not only just for golf, but just the whole environment's going to be a great time. So anyone that can come down and get a chance, opportunity to play, you will enjoy it. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Bushwood Golf and Country Club down in Chickasha. Check that out. You will not be disappointed. It is time now to welcome to the show a great guest. We're looking forward to having him on today. Jim Woodward joining us now. Jim, glad we could find the time to do this today. How's it going?
Well, it's a little bit overcast, a little rainy here out where I live now near Choctaw, Oklahoma. But other than that, pretty good day. I hope some people get out and play golf today. I'm glad that we're getting the golf courses open, letting people get out there and enjoy the great game of golf.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's definitely going to be a rainy week, but we'll do the best we can to make our way out to the golf course. So, Jim, just kind of let everyone know what you're doing now. Before we get into your history, your long time at Oklahoma State and on the tour, kind of let everybody know what you're doing now and where your career in golf's taking you.
Well, you know, I was thinking about it when you guys called to do this. I've been at this about 50 years now. When I started golf was around 12, 13 years old, and I'll be 63 in June. I'm not as busy and as active as I used to be in golf, and I think that's partly because after doing it for that long, you just kind of, you aren't as excited to get up every morning. I do still enjoy teaching. It's what I've done the last, 10 years, basically. And I get more satisfaction out of watching somebody else hit a good golf shot than I do myself anymore. I know that sounds stupid, but I've kind of done and been and gone, and it's kind of more fun now to take a young kid that's just starting, or to take an adult that struggled and to see them hit decent golf shots or good golf shots and smile. I think I get more satisfaction out of that and playing in pro-ams than I do actually worrying about my own game.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you mentioned that there, Jim. And I'm with Colby. I want to get into your stellar playing career that you had, but I want to kind of dig into a little bit more about that instruction that you've been doing, because you seem like you mentioned, over these last few years, you've kind of gained, you know, a passion to see other people succeed at the game even more so than yourself. And you know, I remember one of our podcasts, we had Steve Ball on, one of the best instructors in the state, and he was kind of telling us, you know, the secret sauce is being able to get that kind of mentor student partnership available, you know, develop that chemistry, being able to relate kind of what you see and what you see that the player needs to do, and then be able to work with that and make them being able to connect on different personality levels as well. So, you know, for yourself, Woody, what do you feel like is the most important thing, being able to get to that stage and to where you can get that other player to the next level that they need to be?
You know, it's a great question, Taylor. And sometimes it can't be done. I guess my biggest problem is I've had a lot of people tell me I'm too much of a realist and I'm a little bit of a hard ass when I teach, because if you aren't going to put in the time, then nor am I. And I think it's to be better at golf, you have to spend the time at it. You have to practice and you have to play. And I think playing is more important than practicing. When I grew up playing golf, I didn't beat balls on a range. I didn't have a track, man. I didn't have video. What I had, it was 18 holes, and I had to figure out how to get it in the hole as fast as I could. And I really didn't worry about my golf swing. I just worried about what I shot. And as I watched the change in golf, let's say, I see far too much worrying about how good my swing looks or all my positions in my golf swing. You know, it's cut and dry. They hand you a scorecard. When you're done, you're supposed to put down a score. I don't care how you did it. I don't want to hear about it. What'd you shoot? Okay? And if it wasn't any good, then go practice and go work on it and get better. And if you don't want to do that, then take up bowling. Like I said, my first instructor was Ernie Bossler. And Ernie Bossler was about as big a hard ass as you will ever meet in your life. It was black and white with Ernie. Either you were going to work at it or you were not. And he knew. He could tell if you were working at it or you weren't. And so I guess I'm not really good at being a babysitter. I expect my students to practice and to work. And if they don't, then don't blame me if you don't get any better.
Yeah, fair enough, no doubt. So you mentioned your early lessons there. I'm really curious. You said you didn't take up the game until you were about 12 or 13. Now, you wound up at Oklahoma State, so obviously you were a natural, but kind of take me through your early years in the game of golf and what made you fall in love with it and how you wound up in Stillwater.
Yeah, it's funny. I've had that question asked. I remember it vividly, watching golf one day on television with my dad sitting in the room, and I was probably 10 or 11 years old. And it was Gary Player made a putt on this hole, and the announcer said he just won $20,000. And I thought, how much did he win? I asked my dad, and my dad said he won $20,000. And I said, for playing golf? And he said, yeah. And I thought to myself, $20,000 when you're 10, 11 years old sounds like $50 billion, you know? So I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. So I said, Dad, I'd like to try that golf. And he said, well, son, you're already playing baseball and football. And I said, yeah, well, if you wouldn't mind, would you mind getting me a golf club? And so as time went along, I was still playing Little League football, Little League baseball, like you always do. All kids growing up did that. And then I remember I was probably at that age, 12 or 13, when I got hit so hard at football that I got home and I thought, you know, I didn't really like that. I thought that wasn't very much fun at all. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, all this is going to do is get worse. I'm going to get bigger and they're going to hit harder. And so I said, well, a lot of people call you a wuss, whatever. But I said, no, that's not my cup of tea. And I loved baseball and I was a good little pitcher, but I always got frustrated when I'd throw a good pitch and they'd hit a ball to somebody and they'd muff it. And so my mother always told me I had a terrible, terrible poor sportsman in me. I didn't like to lose. And so when my teammates would mess up, I would get angry. And she said, well, you can't do that because people aren't perfect. And so I was sitting with my dad and I said, well, I don't like this. And he goes, well, then you need to take up that golf. Because here's the thing about golf, you got to play it alone. And you don't need any teammates, and you don't need any help with it. You just got to go hit that ball in the hole. And he said, but let me just tell you, he said, there are no excuses. If you play good, congratulations. If you play bad, it's on you. And I thought, well, that sounds okay with me. And so we were very fortunate. My dad was not a wealthy man, nor my family wasn't wealthy, but they figured a way to join Quail Creek when I was 12 or 13 years old. And that's how I met Ernie Bossler. And that's how I met Chris Cole and other guys in that golf shop that kind of guided me. And it was nothing, guys, for me to play 36 or 45 holes a day and walk. I never even thought about it when I was that age, because it was just my way of getting out, and you didn't need anybody to play with. You could play alone. And it just became a love affair at that point, because I wanted to keep getting better. And you guys that have played golf, anybody's played golf, you're never as good as you want to be. And you always never. Think you found the secret. You know, oh, I got it. I got it today. You know, I found it. I knew exactly what I was looking for, and I found it. And then, darn if you don't wake up the next day and can't find it again. And it just, what better sport to just make you either, well, you either fall in love with it or you fall out of love really, really quick with it. And in all my years of playing, I've found that usually the people that I've met that play golf, that really love golf, are successful. They're either good businesswomen, good businessmen. They are successful. They are driven. They thrive on success. And it's almost notorious that if I look back through my career of all the people that I've been around playing golf, I can't tell you very many losers I met playing golf. I really can't.
Yeah, that's awesome. And unlike my co-host here, Jim, I went to Oklahoma State. I'm an Oklahoma State alum, fan, grew up with orange running through my veins. So now I'm curious, how did you wind up? You took up the game. You got out to Quail Creek. So you had about 5 years under your belt before it was time to make your decision where to play your college golf. How'd you wind up at Oklahoma State?
Well, it was because of one guy only. It was Chris Cole. He was an assistant pro at Quail Creek during that tenure as I was growing up, and he kind of took me under his wing, and he really kind of built that drive in me to be successful. I didn't have a stellar high school career. I did win the state high school when I was a senior year. I ended up winning the Texas-Oklahoma that same year, which was a pretty good little junior tournament back in the day.
Yeah, that's still a big tournament to this day.
And it's kind of funny. It's like my career has always been, I kind of matured late. And so I wanted to go to OSU because mainly how many stories Chris Cole had told me about, Laverne Harris and all the people up there. And I felt like if I went there, I could get better. And that was my whole thought every time I've ever played golf, is I want to keep getting better. And I got recruited by some other colleges, but I didn't think they were as good. And I wanted to go to the best one and see if I could make it on the best team. And so, long story short, that's how I ended up at Oklahoma State. It was Chris Cole, I'd have to say, did it for me. And then and once there, I never regretted it. I didn't get to play as much as I wanted to, but that was nobody's fault but my own. I could have played better. But there were so many good players up there. You had to really, 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 really be good. And so it made me work harder and harder. And I was able to, as I matured, I ended up winning the state high or state amateur. I won the Southern Amateur. I finished high at the Western Amateur. So my career in college was a little bit hit and miss. I did a lot of good things. Looking back, did I play as good as I think I could have? No. But, hell, that's golf. You know what? It wasn't my highlight reel as far as my golf goes, but it wasn't bad.
Yeah, we always tend to remember the opportunities that we missed as opposed to the opportunities that we took care of. You know, that's kind of the downside of this game, and one of the things that we have to work on so hard mentally to try to make sure that we can get around that. And one thing I'm curious from your side, Woody, is that we've had some great guests on our show who have been able to make it to the tour, or who are on the process of making their Taylor Gooch, Ryan Gibson, Sam Humphries. And so right. just from your perspective and where you were at going from OSU, and you were able to get on the tour, I believe I saw you had a total of 125 starts out on the big tour. So, what was your process like going from OSU, where you're competing against so many of these great players, and being able to work on your game to get to that next level? You know, what was the process? What were the tours that you had to play, the different travel you had to do? Just kind of take us through that process.
You know, it's funny. When I got out of school, when I got out of college, I'd had just enough success that I thought maybe I needed to go try to play golf for a living. And at that time, you don't you didn't really have a lot of mini tours, no Corn Ferry, no Web, none of that kind of stuff. And so you had to go to Asia. And Asia was an eye-opener for me. I'd spent 8 weeks over there and got to be really good friends with a lot of guys, one being Payne Stewart, which we spent more time gallivanting through countries that you just read about. You don't really ever get a chance to see. And from the standpoint of a young 22-year-old American, let's just say I got my eyes opened real quick about what the world was. And it made me dang proud to be an American. And it made me also wish that every young woman, man, would have to leave this country for a period of time and go to other countries and figure out, you know what? It's a pretty good deal here in America. It's not bad. And if you think it's not, let me give you a one-way ticket to Calcutta, India, where I spent a week, and see how you like that. So that was an eye-opener. It matured me. But I had to come to Jesus when I was playing, still trying to play. I had I'd qualified for the Western Open at Butler National on a Monday. We could do Monday qualifiers even way back in those days. And I was so excited. Man, I was fired up. And I played, and I thought I played pretty good, but I missed the cut. I think I shot 3 over par or 4 over par for my 2 rounds. And flying home, I was thinking, Tom Watson was 12 under for those 2 rounds. And I was 3 or 4 or 5 over, whatever I was. And so, you know, as you're flying along there, I'm thinking about, well, if I'd made that putt here and if I'd made this putt over there. And when I started having to hold 5 irons from the middle of the fairway to be at 12 under, I knew maybe I was probably not in the right league. So, I mean, I just got my butt beaten so bad. And I thought, you know what? No, I'm not that good. I thought I was good, but I'm not that good. So I immediately decided to go and get a club pro job. I thought that would be the most basic thing that anybody that's in the golf business, of course you want to be in the golf business. If you can't play, you're going to be a club pro. And it went back to those days where Chris Cole and Steve Braley and Hugh Edgman and all those guys that had those OSU alumni. Well, the company that I got to start with was probably the best golf company that ever existed, was Landmark. And, you know, that was the most fortunate break I could have ever got. Also, when I went into the golf business, I went to work for the best. And I learned, again, so much being around those, just those guys were bar none the best company I'd ever seen. And it's just tragedy that we lost that company due to some government BS. Because I still think they would have been the best and would still be going to this day if that hadn't all come down, that savings and loan debacle. So, long story short on that, I started playing a little bit of golf. But when you're an assistant pro, you don't golf much. Well, I got a job opportunity to go out to California in 1984 and be the head golf professional of the club called Wood Ranch that Bud Gill was starting out there in California, and he was the head pro after Ernie Bosford left at Quail Creek. So, as we all know, Taylor, you guys know this, the golf world is a very small community when you get right down to it, and it's very intertwined. And so, I was told early on by Chris Cole that you don't burn any bridges in it, and you always treat yourself or act like a gentleman, be a gentleman. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal. And if you don't do all those, you're going to be okay. And so that was how that job opportunity came up for me. I was only 27 years old and got to be the head golf professional at just a phenomenal club out in California. And only because of the people I'd met and along the way that opportunity came my way. And at that facility, you know what my job description was? You guys are going to love this. The pro, the guy that hired me, he said, Woody, when you get out of here, I want you to go to all the civic type of functions you can. I want you to play in every golf tournament you can get your hands on. And all that time, I want you to spread the word about Wood Ranch. And I looked at him and I said, what? And he said, yeah. He said, that's what I want you to do. He said, you're our Pied Piper. You go tell everybody about Wood Ranch. Well, again, you guys know about golf. If you get out in the community and you start making a name and you start doing well, then people all want to talk about, well, who is this guy? Well, first off, he was an Okie Pinocchio, you know. I had this accent, and I was a hillbilly as far as they thought. But the problem was is this hillbilly was running over him like a Mack truck when it came to playing golf. And I hit a stage there in my life where I was married, had a baby. Let's just say I'd settled down and I'd matured a lot. And so that really worked into my golf game. And I was able to play, oh my gosh, so much more golf than I'd ever played in my life. Also able to qualify for numerous PGA events out there because of the California swing. I was always exempt for San Diego, Bob Hope, LA. So I started playing in professional events, and I started noticing something was different, that they weren't beating me like they were beating me before. And I wasn't missing cuts, and I was fortunate enough to play in the LA Open one year, and Herman Mitchell, who used to caddy for Trevino, you remember the big dude that was just a hoot? I don't know, you guys might.
I know, I've seen the images of him. That's awesome.
Well, he was kind of the godfather of caddies out there at that time, and this was, I was playing the 1986 LA Open at Riviera, and he was caddying for another pro. He didn't have Lee Trevino on the bag, but I got paired with him the last round. And so I play around there, and I think I shot 69 at Riviera, and I don't know that I missed a shot. I mean, it was one of those days that I really did hit it well. And we got finished, and he waddled over to me, and he looked me right in the eye, and he kind of grabbed my shoulder, and he looked at me, and he goes, you need to be out here. I don't know what you do or where you are, what you're doing, but you don't need to be doing that anymore. You need to be out here playing. He said, you have got some game. And boy, that really, you know.
That had to be quite the compliment, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking he only worked for probably the best ball striker ever in Lee Trevino. And he makes this statement to this lowly little club pro from California, and I thought, I'll be darned. So, like always with me, I go home and I think it and think it, and all of a sudden I think, well, if Herman Mitchell thinks I'm good enough, I'm going, hell, I'm all in. So, I went and I resigned my position. I moved back to Oklahoma and proceeded to start playing mini tours in 1988. And played well. I mean, I won a number of events leading up to tour school, and then went through the grind of tour school and missed by one shot. After all those rounds and holes, I missed by one. And that was out in Palm Springs at the PGA West. And
was that back when Q School was it five or six rounds too? What, it was more than four rounds.
It was six rounds. It was 108 holes that you had to play, and prior to that you had to play two other 72 hole events to even get to the 108 holes.
So that's 3 times 4. So that's 14 rounds total. 14 rounds just to even do it.
Yeah.
And missed by one shot. Oh my.
Missed by one shot. And I can tell you that was probably one of the lowest times in my golf career. I mean, of all the things I look back where it hit the hardest was that first year I went to tour school, missed by one measly shot, because again, there was no secondary tour at that point. You were either on the PGA Tour or you were not.
It wasn't
there
like was the PGA Tour and then the Corn Ferry and the McKenzie and the Latin American and the Chinese Tour. Yeah.
No, there was one or none. And when you think that you were that close, so that was a gut wrencher right there. But you know, it took a while to get over that one. And you know, of course, that was right. They always played that at the end of November, right around the first start of December is when it was. And so I made it through Christmas because I had, you know, a little girl and a wife, and I had to make myself feel good about something, but it was a rough December. And so when the new year came around, I thought to myself, okay, you have been in your pity, self-pity waller for long enough. And, you know, that's what I say I loved about golf. You got a choice here. You can make excuses of why you missed, or you can make damn sure you don't do it again. And so that's when you, man, you hit the grind and you work, work, work. And so when 89 came around, I was ready. And I got through it that year. I mean, I fired right on through it because I had, instead of just, you know, like I said, moping around, I went and worked and harder. And so my rookie year, by the time I got there, was 1990. So that's how that all, how the guy from where I was gets to the PGA Tour, and that's it. And then, of course, PGA Tour, there's a lot of stories there. But I guess what I'm saying, guys, is there is no easy route. There is never an easy route. And if you're playing golf, you're going to get knocked down more than you're going to get on top of the world. So, you know, you better figure out how you're going to take all those bumps and bruises and turn them in and make them heal and get back on that horse and ride it again.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Great stuff, Jim. I want to remind everybody, storm season is approaching in the state of Oklahoma. Expected to have some weather throughout this week. Make sure you have McCray Roofing on your radar. If it's good enough for Gallardia, if it's good enough for Oak Tree, it's good enough for you. Their commitment to craft is what defines McCray Roofing and Exteriors. McCray Roofing is a locally owned and operated roofing service company that is passionate about the quality of their roof creations. Jeff McCray, friend of the show here on the 73rd hole, is the owner of McCray Roofing. He views your roof like a canvas, wants to build you a beautiful roof that will last for years to come. Call McCray Roofing today at 405-692-4000 or visit them online at McCrayRoofing.com. Now, Jim, before we get into the 1990s and kind of your PGA Tour career, I want to hop in the time machine with you and go back to 1987, because if you pull up the leaderboard for the 1987 U.S. Open, you don't have to scroll down very far before you find Jim Woodward right there in a T17 out there at the Olympic Club in San Francisco. So take us through what that was like before you had really made a name for yourself on the PGA Tour to get out there and do that at a U.S. Open. Just kind of take us through that experience.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that one up, because that's another one of those ones that was probably, like a little kid in a candy store. I remember going through the qualifier down in Fort Worth to go to the Olympic Club, is where that was played, and I started that 36-hole qualifier with a double bogey on the first hole. And I thought, well, how are we doing now? And I thought, well, hell, I got nothing to lose now. And then I proceeded to play the next 35 holes in 15 under.
Wow.
Oh, ooh, got on a heater.
Yeah, so it was like, oh, wow, you know. And so then when you make it, you go, oh, man. And a funny story about that was by the time I get home from Fort Worth late that night, there's already a message on my phone from a buddy of mine that went to high school with me, a guy named Larry Cooper, said, I want a caddy. And of course, well, I don't have any caddies, you know. I didn't have a caddy.
Sign him up.
So I said, come on, man, let's go. And so off to San Francisco we went. And once again, you're talking about two little hillbillies, because he was worse than me. And we get there Monday morning, and I'd never seen anything like Olympic, and it's still to this day one of my favorite golf courses. If you had to make me play somewhere and say this might be your last round, I'd be hard pressed not to go back to Olympic. And so we're registering on Monday, and what's funny is I told you about how Payne Stewart was a good friend of mine in Asia in 1980 and 81 when I was up there. Well, this is 87. And he's now becoming pretty much a household name on the PGA Tour. And you have you ever played in one? Have you played in an Open, Taylor?
No, I've played in an Open qualifier. No, but I have not played in an Open. No, not.
Well, when you register, there's a sign up sheet that you put your name on to get a tee time. And so I wrote my name down. I think at like 10 o'clock or something on for Tuesday morning, and I get to the first tee on that next morning, get ready to play my round, and who's standing there but Payne? And he said, "I'll be damned." "What are you, son of a?" You know, he said, "Where in the hell have you been? You know, we act like we hadn't seen each other in a long time, which we hadn't, but we're like old friends right off the bat." So I played Tuesday and Wednesday with Payne, and just had a wonderful time. It rekindled that friendship, and he was right there for me when I got on tour. But as we went through those first three practice days, I can't tell you how excited I still was. So when Thursday morning rolled around, well, actually Tuesday night, we got to go out on the USS Enterprise, not the one that Kirk flies around in, the actual aircraft carrier. And at that point's where I got to meet Tom Watson and other guys that went on this little bus tour out there to see that ship. And I met the captain of that ship. And the reason why I'm telling you that, there's another story behind this. And his name was Rocky Spain. And he was just a cool, good guy. And he loved golf. So I made sure he had tickets to the Open. So Thursday morning rolls around. And I've got the very first tee time at 6:45. And let me tell you something. In San Francisco in June at 6:45 in the morning is not warm. It is not warm. And it's foggy and it's cold and it's misty. And we're out there on the driving range and it's dark. I can't even hardly see golf balls, let alone hit them. And all of a sudden you hear this just weird sound. I never heard anything like it. And it's a bagpipe player at the end of the tee box playing his bagpipe, walking through the fog. And man, you know, my caddy looked at me and he looked over it and he goes, "Man, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. This is the real thing." He was perfect for me because he took that edge off. And it was, I mean, chills still go up my arms when I think about that bagpiper coming through the fog. And so, wow, we start off on number one, and after six holes, I'm five over. Okay. And I'm thinking, oh, gosh, this is so embarrassing. And then all of a sudden, I find it going down the 7 through 18, and I get that 5 over back to 3 over, and I shoot 73. And I thought, wow, okay, that's not bad. That's doable, right? So we go out the next day, and we tee off, and through the first 6 holes, I'm 4 over.
And I'm going, those first 6 holes.
I'm like, dang, I cannot get through these first 6 holes. But that 4 over, I get it back to shoot 71. So I shoot 73, 71. I make the cut. And now I'm fired up. I'm thinking, wow, I'm not very high up on the leaderboard, but I've made the cut at the U.S. Open. I'm feeling pretty good about myself. So that next day I'm off and running. I'm thinking I'm going to get those first 6 holes. Well, no, I'm 5 over again. And I'm just livid. I am so pissed off myself. And I do it different ways each time. I don't play the same hole bad every time. But I have one hole in there I can't finish. I'm making a double or a triple on one of those holes. And somehow I get that round back to 72. So if you're doing the math here, I have played the first 6 holes in 14 over in the first 3 rounds, okay? But I'm only, what am I for the golf tournament? I'm 3, I'm 4, 5, I'm 6 over for the golf tournament. So I've gotten, once I get to 7, from then on, I'm 8 under par.
Right, yeah, if it was only a 12-hole 12-hole round tournament, you probably would have won that year.
I'm kicking them. I've got them. So I get, finally, Sunday rolls around, and I'm decent on the leaderboard. I'm probably, 40th or something like that. And I get paired with a guy named Jack Renner. And he used to wear the old Ben Hogan cap. And his claim to fame is Aoki hold a wedge on him in the wide open to beat him while he's sitting in the scoring tent. Oh. And he is, Jack's a good guy. But I'm going to tell you what, he has the personality of a tree stump. I mean, there was absolutely no conversation, no hello, no hardly anything. He was just very, very cold and aloof. And I thought, well, my caddy and I thought, well, hell, that's okay. We don't need anybody. Well, we played the first six holes the final round in even par.
You got to feel like you played them at about five or six under at this point.
let me tell you something. I told my caddy, I said, Coop, call somebody and tell them we're going to win this son of a buck. We're getting ready to light it up. And whereas I didn't play the next 12 holes as good as I had been playing the next 12 holes, I did finish at one under par and shot 69, birdieing 18. And I was, to say I was ecstatic was an understatement. I was such a happy little camper. And I was sitting in the locker room, you know, kind of full of pissing vinegar and thinking I'm something special. And this is when you got to love golf. A good friend of mine, John Cook, comes in and he sits down next to me and he said, "Damn, Woody, I'm sorry." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Well, you were that close." And I go, "Close to what?" I said, "Man, I feel pretty good about how I finished this golf tournament." He goes, "Yeah, but if you'd have finished one shot less, you would have been at the Masters next year."
Oh, no. Oh, God.
And I went, I went from the highest high to one of the lowest lows. At that time, I didn't know it. Taylor, I had no idea, guys. I was thinking I played the best golf I'd ever seen for me. And, well, who knew that top 16 got to go to Augusta in 1987? But believe it or not, if you go back and look at the records, the top 16 guys got to go to Augusta. And so when Cook told me that, you know, you could tell, or he could tell, I didn't know that. And he goes, "Oh, man, I'm sorry. You didn't know that, did you?" And I go, "No." He goes, "Well,
not at all.
Sorry to ruin your day." You know,
you just went from birdie 18 in the U.S. Open feeling ecstatic that you got a high finish. Now, all of a sudden, it's so deflating because, you know, you felt you didn't know you had a chance to go to Augusta, but it was right there, you know.
It was right there. It was right there. And, of course, in the leaderboards, you wouldn't have been able to tell. I was fighting for every stroke I could fight for. And, you know, I did everything I could do. My only regret is I three-putted 17 before I birdied 18. But again, it's that one shot. If you go back, I mean, surely I could have played the first six holes better than the first three rounds. You know what I mean? But that's what's so great about golf. It is what it is. And what I said to you when we started this conversation, I said, "What did you shoot? I don't need to know anything else. What did you shoot?" And again, you meet, here's a great thing about these kinds of stories. First off, remember that captain of the USS Enterprise, Rocky Spain? Well, a year later, I got a telegram, and I got to sail down the coast of California on one of our aircraft carriers, and I got to do everything except go into the nuclear reactor room. I did flight ops. I did not get to land or take off of it, which I still regret to this day that they didn't let me do that. But I launched aircraft. I recovered aircraft. I spent 5 days on the USS Enterprise because I met the captain at the U.S. Open and was kind enough, or just, I didn't say kind enough, I just do this because it's who I am. "Here's tickets, here's anything you need, you be my guest." And he made me his guest on an aircraft carrier for 5 days. So, you just never know, do you?
No, you don't. You know, absolutely not.
You don't get to go on very many aircraft carriers. That's not something that a lowly golf pro from Oklahoma gets to do, but it was that because of that. In 1991, I got a letter from the guy that was running the driving range at Olympic, where I would go hit balls every morning before I teed off. Well, come to find out, he was actually the president and the board of Olympic Club and wanted me to come out and be their head golf professional.
Oh, wow.
Because of who I was or what I'd done during that week, that I treated them so kindly and that I was always professional and I always, it's like everything in golf. You don't know who you're meeting. You don't know who they are or what they are. But my dad, God rest his soul, didn't know one thing about golf. He'd never played golf in his when I took it up. And he said one thing to me that was very important when I got going in the golf business. He said, son, if I could just tell you one thing about this golf, he said, do me a favor, no matter where it takes you, how good you do or bad you do in it, I want you to treat everybody like you'd like to be treated.
Yeah, those are absolutely, I mean, not only just for golf, but just life lessons, you know, Woody.
There you go.
You know, that you're telling them. And, you know, and that's why golf, I feel like, is so great, because you're able to kind of take those, you know, those lessons and incorporate them into life. And that's what makes, the golf will make you a better person in that aspect, which is one of the main reasons that I love it so much. And one thing I was curious, Woody, was that, you know, over during those last two, you got two what I felt like were really big compliments. You know, you had Lee Trevino's caddy, who not only caddy for Trevino, but think about all the different players that he was grouped around and played with and got to see firsthand, and then he gives you a compliment of saying that you should be out there and be playing on the big tour. And then after you got done playing at Olympic Club, you had the owner or whatever the position was come and say, once you'd be the head golf professional at one of the top 15 or 20 courses in the country, you know. So I guess kind of, you know, what you know, you kind of iterated to it, you know, that's just, you know, treat others the way you want to be treated, you know, but kind of try and take us, you know, how humbling it was for you to get kind of compliments like that. And also to, you know, just share on to, you know, other people who may be listening, you know, just some tips or, you know, just ways that they can handle themselves to, you know, to try to help themselves out better. Cause obviously you've been able to have such a lasting impression on all these people.
Well, and please don't get me wrong. I'm sure there's somebody out there probably listening going, well, he wasn't all that nice to me. I had my moments. I mean, if you play golf, you're going to have your moments where you get really disappointed with a lot of stuff. But I think the reason, to me, guys, you got to, golf is not a merry-go-round, and there are certain positions in life. If that's what you like, if you like to just go around in a circle and it never changes, hey, that's great. I mean, that's called conservative. That's called, you know, not having to worry about anything. It's not taking any risk. I feel like that's not what golf is. Golf is a roller coaster. It has highs and it has lows. And you're gonna love the highs and you're going to hate the lows. But if you don't want to do that, then go ahead and get on the merry-go-round. And then you won't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So it's like anything you do in life is you take risk. That's why they're called a risk. You might come out ahead and you might not. And so when I look at the golf as in life, like you said, Taylor, if you think it's always going to be perfect, you're wrong. And I can only say that I was able to get through some really rough times in life and in golf because of my faith. And I feel sorry for anybody out there that doesn't, you know, have a strong bond with Christ and a really an ability to take that and let that handle your problems. Give it to Him. He'll guide you. There's been more than one case, and I've said, hey, I don't know what I'm doing this time. Help me. Tell me where to go. And it always seems like I find a path. And one of my lowest points is when I broke my kneecap in the Houston Open in 1993. I broke my patella.
Now this sounds like a story. We got it. Don't spare no detail about how you did this.
Well, it actually ended up taking me off the tour, which at the time I didn't know much about a patella, but you've learned a lot about it here if you're a Thunder fan with Andre Robertson. And when I heard that was his injury, I knew he wasn't coming back, guys, because I was a lowly golf pro, and I couldn't come back from it, and all I had to do was swing a golf club. He's got to run and cut and do all those things. But it was a weird deal, as always. Everything in my life seems to be something that you can't believe. You need to write a book about. But I was at the Houston Open in 1993, coming off my best year on tour in 1992. Had played some really good golf in 92. I would have won the Byron Nelson, I still believe to this day, if it hadn't gotten rained out. So I was rolling. I had found my niche. I thought, I'm pretty good. I'm not Greg Norman or one of these superstars, but I'm not bad. I can do this for a living, I felt. So we're playing along there, and it's 17. I'm sure you guys played the Woodlands, right, down there at the TPC at Woodlands? Have you guys played it?
Down in Carlton Woods?
Yeah, down in Houston, you know, Waterwood. Down there, you know where I'm talking.
Yeah, yeah, I know exactly where. Yeah, I haven't I haven't gotten a chance to play yet. I actually applied to play the AJGA. They have a huge event there, or they, at least they used to every year, and I think I was like one of the fourth or fifth alternates that ended up not getting in the tournament. Man. So I haven't gotten a chance to play it, but I've heard nothing but beautiful and elegant things about it.
Oh, it's a heck of a golf course. But the 17th hole there is a dogleg around a lake. And you really, you hit like a fairway wood or an iron off the tee, and then the green's an island green, and you knock it on to there. It's as short as hole. You only got a wedge or something like that to the hole if you can hit the fairway. Well, this is my 71st hole, and I'm playing pretty good. I think I'm in the top 20, 25 going into that hole, I feel like. And so I hook my tee shot a little bit left, it kind of catches a hill, and it almost rolls down the water, but it doesn't quite. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if I stand right on the edge, I don't have to take my shoes off and all that. I can stand and I can hit a hook with this wedge and knock it on the green. I really felt like I could do that shot without getting myself all wet. Mm-hmm. So I dig my heels into the side of this bank, and I'm aimed way out to the right, you know, so you're going to hit a big sweeping hook. Well, I take this massive swing with this wedge, and I hit this ball solid as hell, and all of a sudden I hear this really, really, really loud pop that sounded like a gun went off. And long story short, not only did I not just get my feet wet, I got my whole body wet because I just completely collapsed and fell back into the lake. Now, thank goodness the Golf Channel didn't exist and nobody had filmed it, because it had to be a riot when it happened. And I thought, oh man, I felt a pain like I had never felt in all my days. And I actually was laying in the lake. Luckily, the lake was not real deep, so I actually, when I fell, my back was in the mud, and I could hold my club above the water because I was so afraid. If that ball didn't clear the lake to get on the green, it was going to go into the water. Well, I'm laying in the water, and if I've got the club in the water, then I'm grounding my club.
Oh, that's something you don't even think about in a situation like that, or normally.
Yeah, so I'm laying in that muck, and I'm looking up at my caddy, and he's looking at me going, what in the hell? What are you doing? And I say to him, I say, where is the ball? And he goes, oh, well, the ball's on the green. Well, you hit a great shot. So I throw the club up towards him, and I said, now help me out. And he comes down there, and he pulls me out of the muck, and I come walking up on the bank, and I got to tell you, I couldn't put hardly any weight on my right leg. And I thought, man, I've done something stupid bad here. And so I get up there, and I'm able to putt, and then believe it or not, I played 18 on basically one leg. I hit a 3-wood, a 4-iron, about a wedge from 100 yards and made the putt for par. And it was probably still one of the best pars you'll ever see on the 18th hole at the Woodlands. And I went into the locker room, and I'm all muddy, so I got to try to get some clothes and change. And there was an acupuncturist in there, believe it or not. And I was limping around. He said, what's wrong with you? And I said, well, I hurt my knee on the last hole. And he said, well, here, let me help you out. He said, you ever had acupuncture? And I said, no. And dumb me. So I popped that leg up on this bench, and I let him pull out these needles, and he sticks this first needle in there, and he flicks the top of it like you'd shoot a penny or something. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you something, guys, it was x-rated, but I'm not sure how many MFs or what I said, but if I didn't touch the ceiling, I'm shocked. And basically told him, do not do that again. Get that thing out of my leg. I don't know what he hit. There was some nerve in there or something, but I was ready to kill somebody with that pain. So I get dressed. I get to the airport. I fly home. Luckily, it's only Houston, you know, so it's a short flight. I get home to my house, and I call an orthopedic surgeon that was a member at Quail Creek, because that's where I was playing out of at the time. And it was the Dr. Payne. I'll never forget him, Ralph Payne. And he said, Woody, do me a favor, don't eat anything, and be at my office at 8 o'clock the next morning. I said, okay. So I don't eat anything. I go into his office, and he pops me up on the table. And by now, my leg's swollen. It doesn't look very good. And he said, okay, I'm going to stick a needle in your leg, and we're going to see if we get any blood. If we get blood, he says, we're going to have to take you right to surgery. Well, I am not good with blood. I am not good with doctors.
You're me like either. No, no.
I just don't do well in that kind of situation. So I'm sitting there, and first off, when he sticks that needle in my leg, that almost makes me pass out. But then when he starts pulling and all there is blood, I went, oh my God. And I mean, I know I almost passed out then. And Dr. Payne looked at me and says, okay, well, let's take in see what we got. Well, we went in and he did surgery and he said, I'll see you in 6 weeks. And I said, 6 weeks? He goes, yeah. I go, okay. So I come back in 6 weeks, and he really didn't tell me what was wrong. And I come back in 6 weeks, and he unravels the gauze, and sticking out of my knee is two wires, metal wires. And I was thinking, what in the world are those doing in my leg? And I was thinking, you know, it'd be like a scar, like a normal ACL or something like that, where it wouldn't be. There wouldn't be much. Well, no, there was a big scar and there was two wires sticking out of it, both sides of it. And he said, I hate to tell you, but he said, you got some real damage in there. And I said, what'd I do? And that's when he said that you tore your patella up bad. Well, I didn't know what a patella was, but, let me tell you something. It's not what you want to do if you knee. If you ever hurt your knee, hopefully they won't say it's patella because, at that time, the PGA Tour did not have a medical.
Oh, no.
You're not going to believe that, but I was a totally exempt player, and they did not have any kind of medical for me because I hadn't been on the tour long enough. You have to be on the tour for like 5 years to be able to get a medical.
Yeah, and that's tough.
I said, what? I said, so what am I going to do? And they said, well, you know, hopefully you'll get healed up and you come back and you make enough money, or worst case scenario, what we might do is give you a full exemption into the finals at tour school. And I went, well, that doesn't seem fair, guys, because I was an exempt player this year. I finished 81st on the money list or something like that. I'm legit. I'm exempt. They said, well, we're sorry, we don't have anything for you.
What time of the year was the Houston Open back then, Jim?
It was around
May. It was April.
Yeah, it was April. April. Okay, so yeah, so after about, you had to go back 6 weeks. So you would have, if you would have been able to come back, you would have only been able to play a handful of tournaments and been able to try to get into that money list spot.
It basically, what I did is I came back too early because I tried to do what you were saying. I think I came back in August and tried to play.
Yeah, you came back August 1st. I'm looking at your schedule here, and I was actually going to ask you about that because that's a really short turnaround. The Shell Houston Open ended. The Sunday round was May 2nd, and you were back out there. The Sunday round of the St. Jude was August 1st. So that's actually just a hair under 3 months you were back playing on tour.
Yeah, and that was a mistake. Let me just tell you, it's easy to say it took me on, but I think it did. I didn't give it time. And so I played, you know, just I tried to invent a golf swing to play with pain. And anybody that's played golf knows if you're doing that, it doesn't matter. Well, even if you're Tiger Woods, the best player probably ever, when he's playing in pain, he's not very good, is he? And
no, we saw that first turn, except for 2008 U.S. Open. But even after that, you know, we saw his back issues. He was withdrawn after two or three holes, a lot of tournaments.
Yeah, you just can't do it. And, you know, and again, this is where in life, you can cast blame. You can say, well, the PGA Tour screwed me and da-da-da-da-da. It's easy to always blame somebody else. You know what? But it's also just as easy to accept things. That's how it works sometimes. You know what? I wasn't meant to stay on the PGA Tour. If I was, I would have hit that ball on 17 in the middle of the fairway, or I would have just taken a drop. But I didn't make those two decisions. Those happened because they happened. And so, you know, you can, again, you can sit around and self-pity and cry about, well, I didn't get a good break there, you know, da-da-da. But when it all said and done, nobody cares. Gil Morgan said it best to me when I came out on tour. He said, Woody, you're a very likable guy, but let me just tell you this. He said about 75-80% of the guys don't care what you shoot, and the other 20% hope you shot higher. So, and it sounds cold blooded, but that's what golf is. That is what it is. It is cut and dried. And so when you talk about a crazy story, and you know what? I'll tell you guys, I bet I haven't told that story to very few people. Very few people. Some of my closest friends I've told that story to, because I don't want to sound like I got the worst break in the world and that's what took me off the tour. You know what? Because it is what it is. And I did it. I broke it. I came back too early. I made all the decisions that ended up costing me my career. Nobody forced me back out there. I did it on my own. So it's real easy. Again, like I say, I go through life listening to people complain all the time. And anytime I'm around somebody that's negative, guess what? I don't stay around them long. I get the hell away from them because I just don't like anybody whose glass is half empty. I'm just not that guy.
Yeah, Jim, that's a phenomenal outlook. It really is.
It's the only way. If you want to be successful, that's the only chance you got. And I'm thinking that I probably wouldn't have been a good rich guy anyway, because I would have just pissed it away and given it all away anyway. So I'm better off that I didn't ever have a really great income.
Right, yeah. Jim Woodward joining us today on the 73rd hole. Some great stories. We got some more good ones coming up on the other side. We need to take a quick break, and then we're going to get Jim to tell us a few Payne Stewart stories, maybe keep things rolling here on the 73rd hole. So stay with us. We're back on the other side. Colby Powell, Taylor Williams, Jim Woodward joining us today. Stay with us on the 73rd hole.
When something the size of a golf ball hits your roof, you need to call McRae Roofing. McRae Roofing is Oklahoma's designer roofing service specialist. For years, Jeff McRae and the experienced team at McRae Roofing and Exteriors have served fellow Oklahomans by helping them with their roofing needs. McRae Roofing uses only top quality materials and professional crews to make sure that each job is done right, so it will give you the years of service, security, and protection you need from the unpredictable Oklahoma weather. McRae Roofing offers residential and commercial roofing, ventilation services, and custom copper designs. McRae Roofing is dedicated to exceeding the homeowner's expectations. It's not just a roof, it is your home's crowning glory. Call McRae Roofing today at 405-692-4000. That's 405-692-4000. Make sure to also visit their website at mcraeroofing.com. That's M-C-R-A-Y roofing.com. Don't get caught with a leaking roof. Contact McRae Roofing for your free inspection today.
Welcome back in. We're rolling along here on the 73rd hole. Colby Powell, Taylor Williams, Jim Woodward joining us today. I want to remind everybody, head on down to Chickasha to Taylor and I's stomping grounds. Play Bushwood Golf and Country Club down there, getting things going. Big Memorial Day tournament coming up here in a couple weeks. Two-day event. You're not going to want to miss that. The pool's going to be opening up, full bar at the pool. So head down to Chickasha. Taylor and I grew up on that course. You will like it. You will not be disappointed. Head on down that way. Bushwood Country Club. Tell them the 73rd hole sent you. All right, Jim Woodward, still with us here on the 73rd hole. Now, Jim, I got to ask, you mentioned your friendship with Payne Stewart that kind of blossomed in the early 80s over in Asia. What are some good Payne Stewart stories? Obviously, taken from the game of golf way too soon, but everybody just speaks so highly of Payne Stewart. So I want to know from somebody who was good friends with him, what was it like traveling around with Payne?
Well, first off, tell Max Lowe for me at Bushwood. I love that little golf course. What a great place to grow up. I'm jealous of you and Coley. That's pretty cool. Payne Stewart, probably a very misunderstood kind of guy by a lot of people. You know, Payne would come across kind of arrogant if you didn't know him. He had a real dry sense of humor. But another one of those guys that, like I said, was such a good dude. I mean, we spent that time in Asia, and there he was signed up with me to play those practice rounds. And when I got my tour privileges, he was right there. I mean, he was right there as a mentor, everything he could tell me and help me with. But a funny story about old Payne, and these are stories about how golf gods will come back to get you, I think. That 87 Open when we were playing, that 17th hole at Olympic was actually a par 5 that they turned into a par 4. And it was an impossible hole. The fairway sloped very hard from left to right. And if you got it down into the rough, you had no chance to hit the green. And so keeping the ball in the fairway was really tough. But then trying to hit it on the green was even tougher because it's a par five green that we had 200-plus yard shots to try to find a way to get the ball on the green. And then if you could hit the green was so undulating and so fast, it was just scary. So it was Wednesday, the day before we were to start to open, and we're standing on that green. And there was a USGA official over there in his, you know, his blue jacket and his white shirt and his red tie and his little banner on his lapel that said how he was USGA official. And Payne's standing there, and I'm standing next to him, and we're just kind of looking at this green, and he goes, "Hey, come here," mentioning over there to that official. So that official comes walking over to him, and I'm thinking, I wonder what this is all about, you know? And so Payne takes this golf ball. This guy comes walking up to us, and Payne takes this golf ball, and he drops it on the green, and the ball just rolls all the way off the green and down into the rough. And he looks at this guy, and he says, "You sorry SOBs, you MFs, this is a bunch of BS, you mother," again.
And he's using those abbreviations, right?
Yeah. And I was standing there. Well, first off, my jaw hit the green, so I had to pick that up first. And then I just kind of turned and started moving away because I'm thinking, I don't want this official to even know me, to look at me or anything. Because, I mean, I'm a nobody. I'm so excited to be at the U.S. Open. And Payne just goes off on this guy. And where I thought it was a kind of an unfair hole, I would have never called the official over and did what he did. So anyway, he gets done berating him, and we go move our way off the green over to 18T, and I go, "Gee whiz, Bart." I said, "Don't you think you kind of went a little far there?" And he goes, "Oh, those sorry sacks of black people. You know, I don't like any one of them jerk-offs." And so, well, why don't we fast forward a few years to when Payne Stewart is at Olympic again, and Lee Jansen and him are in a dogfight. And I think you guys remember what happened on the back nine, the debit that he drove in on 12 or 13. I don't remember which hole it was, but somewhere on that back nine, he hit it into a debit and it cost him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, to show you the kind of guy I am, I made sure to call Payne and let him know that the reason that happened is because he had chewed that guy out. So the karma, the golf gods came back to haunt him. Well, of course, I was good enough friends with him, I could get away with that. And I waited a few days after the Open was over before I made that phone call. And but with that, I got a nice little FU from him. And the next tournament that I was paired with him out there, we were on the same event. When I went to get my shoes out of my locker, there were two bananas stuffed in the toes of them. So he got me back a little bit there. But you're right. That was really a sad day when I heard about him. You know, I caught wind of it that plane was flying along there, and I've flown enough airplanes and known enough as far as pilots go and knowledge of it to know that was not going to turn out well for him when they just kept going up and up and up, and there was no way you could see in there because it iced over. You knew a decompression had happened. So that was a sad day. I remember it was a Monday, and I was at Quail Creek. Actually, we had a Monday outside of Bent, and I didn't even want to watch the TV because I knew what was going to happen. So, yeah, we lost him way too early. He would have been something else on that Champions Tour.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, Woody. And, I mean, I remember it happened back in 1999, so I would have been only 6 years old, and I remember very vividly watching his funeral. And I believe they canceled the final round of the Tour Championship or one of the events that year in memory so everyone could go to the service. And just how impactful that was back then, not only just on some of my age, but just the whole golf community. You know, like we mentioned before, it's close-knit, and it's just how hurtful it is to see someone that we've all looked up to like that, you know, pass away. It's so sad. But, you know, let's try to break off from some of the sad moments again and some more of the good funny stories here. So you know, so like I said, you mentioned you got some funny stories there on Payne, who you know, like I said, we all remember and was obviously a great guy. What are some other may not even have to be on the tour, but just some of the stories that you've experienced in golf that that you would like to share, you, that you find funny to this day whenever you look back on them, or that you can joke around with your friends with?
Oh, you know, some of my most fun times that I've ever had in golf, believe it or not, were pro-ams. I used to love to play on tour in the pro-ams, and I used to love to play. I still do. That's the only golf I really play, you guys, is I get four or five members together from Oak Tree or wherever, and we go to Arizona, or we go to California, or we go someplace, you know, Cabo or wherever it might be, and play golf. But what I've found about golf is, you know, everybody wants to talk about playing golf on tour and those kinds of things. But, you know, when it gets down to nerves and you know, everybody would say to me, how do you play for that much money? I never thought about the money. It was just about playing for winning or losing. And these guys, everybody's listening to your podcast as a golfer knows, if they're playing the club championship, the level of, I hate to use the word choking, but we all know when it's tough to get air in your lungs, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a PGA Tour event or it's your club championship, or it's you guys are trying to beat each other for $5 and you got the 5-footer and you know you got to make it to win, you still got those nerves. So when I play with these guys in these events, it always cracks me up to watch when they get under the gun, how difficult it becomes compared to when they're just out goofing around with their friends. And so I had one buddy of mine, I won't tell you his name because we don't want to embarrass him, but he was the worst putter I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, the worst. He was horrible. And we were at a golf tournament, and finally I told him, I said, you know what? You need to do me a favor. He said, what? I'll try anything. And I said, you really? You'll try anything? And he goes, I'll try anything. And I said, okay, I want you to hit this next putt, and I want you to shut your eyes. He goes, what? And I said, I want you to get lined up, get your putter where you want it, and then right before you take your putter back, I want you to shut your eyes and just putt. He goes, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I said, well, it's as bad a putter as you are. What do you got to lose? And he kind of looked at me and goes, well, that's probably a good point. I said, well, you can't. It's hard to fall out of a ditch. You're the worst putter I've ever seen. So what do you got? Give it a shot. So it was about a 20-foot putt. And you guys, you're not going to believe it, but he made it.
He held it with his eyes closed.
Hold it with his eyes.
That's an old Johnny Miller trick, I believe. I believe he was notorious for being a bad putter, and he tried doing that for a little bit too. So it apparently worked for your friend at that point. But continue with the story. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
Well, it's funny because it is an old way to get out of the yips. Because if you don't know when the putter's going to hit the ball, how do you yip? And so that was, he made this first putt, and so immediately this is typical of a golfer. He immediately turns it right back on me, and he says, why didn't you tell me that before now?
While 2 minutes before he was criticizing you for even recommending it in the first place.
There you go. There's a typical golfer. Then it became, well, you should have told me that earlier. Well, and long story on that, he didn't do it for very long before he gave up on it. I mean, it was like, well, that didn't work for. I mean, that was okay for a while, but it didn't work. It's typical. That's you guys are laughing because I know you know what I'm talking about. A golfer, he only will do something for as long as it seems like it works, and then when it doesn't, I gotta go try something else. It's not the fact that it might. Just give it a minute; it'll come back. Oh heck, no! Let's find something else. There's got to be another holy grail, you know, and. So when you talk about humor, I always get tickled. Even today, when I teach, it's really fun for me that you will tell somebody to do something, and I'm always excited about it because I've got about a window of about 10 minutes when I tell somebody to try something when they're hitting a golf ball, that if they are in success within that 10-minute window, I'm done. They're going to move on. They're not going to come back to me, or they're going to think that didn't work, or I got to try something else, or whatever it might be. I truly believe, I think I could take somebody in the first 10 minutes and talk them from being a right-handed golfer to a left-handed golfer, or vice versa, just for that little bit of time. And if they'd hit one good shot, I think I could get them for life. I could turn them over for at least a little while. But that is what a golfer is. Immediate results. I want immediate. I don't want to have to work at this. Give me a pill, like everything we do in our lives. Give me a pill and make me feel better. Or if I don't get it immediate, then I got to try something else. Hey, you guys, you know what I'm talking about?
No, 100%. 100%.
We've all been there.
Yeah,
absolutely. There's not a golfer alive that hasn't been there. The only thing I can tell your host and your guest and anybody listening is give it time. Rome wasn't built in a day. If you're working on something with a golf instructor, give him time. And if you're not working after he's helped you, then it's not his fault. So, I make fun of people when I teach because it lightens it a little bit. It makes them realize that, do you realize how stupid you are standing here complaining about this or that when there's lots bigger things to worry about? So I always try to defuse a situation where they're really working too hard at it or thinking too much. They can't even get the golf club back because they got so many thoughts in their mind. So as far as humor goes, I've probably got some great stories, but the problem is they're kind of X-rated, so I can't really get into a lot of them.
I understand. Yeah.
Right. I understand. So then one thing I wanted to ask you about, we'll kind of turn the page here, is in 2012, you won the Senior PGA Pro National, and you did it by eagling the final hole. It says here on the Golf Channel story that you had a four hybrid to a foot from 245 out to eagle 18 and win the golf tournament. So what was that like?
Well, as you guys well know, you've played golf tournaments. What it doesn't tell you is earlier in the day, I started that round by bogeying the second hole and doubling the third hole. So it is, again, one of those kinds of days where if you let it go south, it can. And I just hung around and hung around and hung around that last day. I was leading when I started, then I fell way behind, and all of a sudden, coming down the stretch, I was right back in the golf tournament because the guy I was playing with had taken lead and ran into a landmine or two. So he fizzled and burned out. So by the time I got to the 18th hole, I thought I needed a birdie to win because the guy in front of me was at even par. I was at even par. I was at one over for the golf tournament, and he was at even par, and I thought if I could birdie the last hole, I could win it. And I didn't realize he'd birdied the last hole. So what that tells me then is he knew I had to make eagle. But I had struggled with that golf course. I didn't like that golf course. I didn't get along well with that golf course, even though I did shoot a course record third round on it. I still struggled with it, and I really struggled with the 18th hole. I couldn't figure out how to play it. So we got there, and there was a little wind behind it. So when you think about a 240-yard four-iron hybrid, it's a little wind-aided, let's just say that, and it was definitely a little pumped-up-aided. But I thought, okay, I'm going to play this hole aggressive. I've tried playing it like a coward for basically every time I played it, and I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to hit driver because it's a real tight driving hole, and then I'm going to see if I knock it on the green. I'm going to two-putt, and I'm going to win this golf tournament. Well, I hit the driver, and I couldn't hit it better if I tried. It was just flushed right where I wanted it, perfect. So we get down there, and it was 240, but I needed to carry it probably 220 is all I needed to carry it to get to the front of the green. It was a big, long green, and I thought, well, all I'm going to try to do is hit this four hybrid up on there and get it on the green somewhere, two putt, and get out of this thing. Well, I'd love to tell you that I focused and I had this great swing. Heck, to this day, I don't know how the hell I hit that shot. I just swung it, and the dang thing sounded. It took off, and it couldn't have been a prettier shot. I mean, it was just absolutely just striped, just like my driver was. And I knew it flew over the bunkers that were in front. So, but I didn't know exactly where it was. So I was in a cart by myself, and because we were seniors, we'd take carts. I loved it. Anyway, I pull up to the green, and I look up there, and there's a ball sitting about 2 feet from the hole. And I went, oh, shit. I mean, wow. I can two-putt that. I got this thing. I'm a winner, winner, chicken dinner. I've just won this golf tournament. And I'm kind of full of piss and vinegar and pomp and ceremony. I'm getting my putter out, and there's a couple of my buddies standing there, and they go, holy crap, nice shot. Now make that putt. And I go, well, yeah, I think I can two-putt. And they go, no, you got to make that putt. Miles birdied 18.
Oh, no.
Well, now all of a sudden it felt like that. Many times I played golf, I get this big pit in my stomach going, oh, no. So I'm walking to that putt. Well, the guys I'm playing with are having a bad hole. They're all over the place on this last hole. So I mark the ball, you know, and I'm looking, and then I kind of look at it, and then I think, quit looking at this. So I just turn and immediately walk away. I'm not going to look at this putt. I'm not going to putt it till it's my turn. And that's one of those times it felt like an eternity before I got to putt that ball. Because these guys were chopping it here, chopping it there. You know, then by the time they got on the green, they had to all putt and get out of my way. So, like I said, it seemed like an eternity. But when I finally got to put the ball down, I looked at it and I thought, oh, it's a foot and a half, 2 feet. Just hit it. So I got up there and I was able to go through my routine, and somehow it did go in. And there's the end of that story. So, but, you know, to tell you, I had that shot up my whole life. I knew exactly what I was doing. I'll bet you if you put me on that tee box again and gave me 10 balls, I couldn't do it again. But I don't have to. I did it that time.
Yeah, you did it the time it mattered. That's what matters.
And that's when it mattered. So, you know, it was, I guess that was kind of my, I wouldn't say my swan song, but it was kind of what I wanted to do one more time. I wanted to win something at a national level, that not to prove to anybody else. I've never been one to, I mean, you guys have got me to talk about myself more today than I think I have in my whole life. I don't talk about myself. I don't talk about anything. In fact, guys, if you came to my house or you looked around, you might not find a trophy. I don't keep them. And everybody goes, how could you not keep your trophies? And well, because I don't know. I don't know where they all went. I got divorced once and lost a lot of them. I don't know where they went. Because I didn't play for that. I didn't really play for money. I played because I wanted to see how good I could be. I didn't care about anybody else. I just wanted to see what I personally could achieve at the highest level. And I had not won as a club pro at the highest level. I came close when I was playing the regular CPC, as they called it. And I knew I was good enough to beat these guys at this senior deal. And that wasn't brag, that was fact. I just knew I was a pretty darn good little player and I could beat everybody in that field, but I'd never done it. So I wanted that. I wanted to say, okay, and it's kind of funny. Once I did that, I played a few more majors and I played a few more things, but I kind of knew that, all right, I've been very lucky. I've done a lot of great things and gotten away with a lot of stuff in golf, and it's been really good to me. Now give back, you know, get involved in that teaching, give back to the local schools, give whatever knowledge I got and whoever wants to listen to it, which is not very many people. And move on. I mean, I don't want it to ever be said that, oh, that Woody, he was so full of himself. No, I'm not that guy. I've never been that guy, and I don't want to be tomorrow or the next day.
It's very, very humbling, Woody, absolutely, and I think we're in the same a lot of characteristics there. And, you know, one thing, I try to ask this from all of our guests who have definitely played at a high level. One of the most things I'm fascinated with in golf is the difference between – you know, there's kind of different stages in everyone's game. You know, there's the, you know, the cream de la cour, you know, the Rorys, the Brookses, the Koepkas. Then there's, you know, your guys that are out there on tour for 10 to 15 years. Then there's the next level of guys that get out there for a year or two and then they fade off. Then there's the gap of people that stay on the web and can't ever get past that barrier. And, you know, there's just those right. different levels and phases, you know. And so from your experience, Woody, you know, what have you seen that is, you know, kind of helps transcend those players to get over into those next levels? You know, some of the things I've written down that you said here are, you know, just general love for the game, you know, just a deep down passion for success, you know, not really caring about what others think or what their thoughts are and just wanting to succeed for yourself. So kind of breaking off some of those things you said or any of the other points that you have in your head to kind of give our listeners, because we have a lot of our listeners are kind of either at the elite junior level or college level, right, where they are trying to get to that next step.
Well, and I'll tell you guys, I've said this to more than one parent and to more than one upstart player that wants to go and chase that dream. If you get right down to it, there's only 125 guys in the world that are exempt to play on the PGA Tour. Now, there's that category that'll take them to 150 and 175 where they got partial. I'm talking about exempt. I'm talking about guys that know they've got a job for that year. There's 125 in the world. Boy, that's a real small number when you think about it.
At a 7.6 billion? Absolutely.
It's a real small number. So the first thing I always like to try to tell somebody is be realistic. The odds of you being one of those is against you when you start. Okay? And Mike Holder once told somebody about me, he said, that boy's got more God-given talents than anybody I've ever met. And that might be true, because that might be the only way I ever made it to the PGA Tour, is I had God-given talent. And I worked my butt off. Don't think I didn't. I worked at it. I was a grinding little son of a gun. When I wanted to work, I could work. And, you know, Holder and I used to always fight because he felt like I had too much of a lackadaisical attitude. I didn't seem like I was cutthroat enough. And what he didn't understand is that was my persona. That's how I was, stayed calm, is I'd joke and I'd act like I wasn't grinding. And I was, because trust me, if I was playing you in golf, I'd cut your heart out and stomp on it. And then when we're done, I'll be your friend, but not while we're playing. And my wife to these days actually tells me with our grandkids, Woody, you don't have to beat them at every game. Yeah, I do. I don't play unless I'm trying to win. And that was bad. So, but it is good. That's the only way you can be if you're going to be at that level. I will say this, though. You ask a great question there. I'm going to tell you what, buddy, and it's going to sound surprising to you. It takes one or two really good breaks at the right time. And the reason why I say that is because I know in my career I had one or two breaks that took me the wrong way and one or two breaks that took me the right way on more than one occasion. And if you don't believe it, you can go through your guys' playing history and you'll see there was an instance here, an instance there, if it had gone this way or it had gone that way. And that's what we were talking about earlier. I don't dwell on ifs. I just dwell on facts. And I think a lot of guys don't make it to that level because they live in the past. They don't look to the future. And they want to talk about, I could have done this, I should have done that, instead of getting off their butts and going and finding a way to do it. If you live in the past, you are stuck in the past. You can live in the present, but you really need to live in the future. You need to think, what's the best thing for me to do to get to that level? And if they don't, you know what? It's not, for goodness sake, it's not the end of the world. It's still, if they're a golfer, they've got so many positives in their life that they're going to be excellent at something, whatever they want to do. So if it isn't golf, if you don't want to be a club pro or you don't want to get on tour and you can't do this and you want to go in the insurance business or you want to go be a lawyer, I don't care. Just go be the best person you can be and do what your golf taught you to do, and you'll be successful. And for goodness sakes, don't live in the past. If you're going to live in the past, you're never going to get to be successful. I'm just telling you. It won't work.
Yeah, that's great stuff. That's all great and great advice. Jim, you've been phenomenal today. We appreciate you sharing all the stories with us. I don't know how your teaching works, if you have an open lesson book or anything like that, or if there's a way for people to get a hold of you if they want to come see you. How does all that work, or do you just do private lessons? Kind of what's your schedule look like?
Oh, I do mostly private lessons. I work out of Oak Tree National is where I work. And if you contact Oak Tree National, they have my cell phone number, and they'll be more than happy to give it to you. They haven't hesitated to do it. I get all kinds of people call me. so it's okay with me. That's what I do now more than anything is I just teach, and I've got 40 acres of land. I'm learning how to be a farmer. I've got a great life. I've been a one lucky son of a gun.
Jim, that's awesome. We appreciate your time today. You've been great. We hope to do this again in the future. And looking forward to golf getting back going. We got the big match with Ricky and Matt Wolf next week, and then Tiger and Phil. And then we'll have some golf on the TV finally.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't ask me about that because I'm not very politically correct about that. I think it's a scam, but I'll just move on from there.
Fair enough. We couldn't appreciate it more, Jim. Thank you.
All right, guys. You take care.
That was Jim Woodward joining us here on the 73rd hole. Great interview today. We really appreciate him taking the time. A lot of great stories from his playing career, his time with Payne Stewart, his time at Oklahoma State. Really enjoyed that. I want to remind everybody, find us on social media, the 73rd hole, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check us out on all those different platforms. Rate and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. And remember, as the storms roll through this week, give McCray Roofing a call. And then once the storms clear out, head on down to Chickasha, Bushwood Golf and Country Club. Have yourself a good time down in Taylor and I's hometown. Glad everyone was with us today. We're back later in the week with another edition of the 73rd hole.